together we will win a majority of the delegates, and together we will beat Hillary Clinton in November.
We have now won 7 out of 8 of the last caucuses and primaries.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning. Welcome to the program. Today is Wednesday. It is April 6, 2016. I'm Steve Grzanich. Thanks for being along with us on this wet Wednesday morning. Lots going on today. Best-selling author Dan Lyons is with us this morning, who's written a book. Dan Lyons, the book is about all of his activities, his foray into the world of startups. It's quite a good book. He has really some good stories to tell. That's coming up here on The Opening Bell. But first, let's give you the overnight global market intel from the WGN market desk. The dollar edged up from a 17-month low against the yen, and buffeted European share prices latched onto a rebound in oil to move to their lowest level in over a month. Asian trading had been subdued, and the mood persisted in Europe as share prices struggled to build on some early momentum. But the damage done overseas in Asia, especially, where the Nikkei ended the night off about 17 points, the Shanghai off as well. In Europe, the story not much better, but the markets, at least major indices there, are all in the green this morning. Dow futures are pointing toward a higher open later on Wall Street. Yesterday, the Dow Jones Industrials finished the day off about 133 points. The Standard & Poor's 500 lost about 20 points to 20.45.17. The NASDAQ Composite fell about 47 points, and the stocks remained lower most of the day. Benchmark U.S. crude oil edged up about 19 cents to close at $35.89 a barrel. On the New York Mercantile, Brent crude used to price international oil rose only 18 cents to about $37 a barrel. Federal health officials have approved a cheaper version of Johnson & Johnson's top-selling drug, Remicade, a pricey biotech medicine for inflammatory diseases. The approval of the drug is only the second time that the Food and Drug Administration has approved a quasi-generic version of a biotech drug for the U.S. market. There's a lot of talk today about inversion. We're going to have a discussion later in the broadcast with Dale Buss about Ford moving a plant to Mexico. Yesterday, the president also spoke about inversion. We'll tell you what it's all about and why so many people are up in arms. Ford, again, the latest to announce a move to another country. Also this morning, there is a word that deal that we were talking about between Pfizer and Allergan has been put off because of inversion. Pfizer is saying it's going to walk away from that deal. That announcement has not been confirmed by either of the companies, but it's being reported this morning by CNBC and by the Reuters news organization. Other business news that we're watching for you this morning, the price of stocks around the world higher today. Again, the Dow futures pointing toward a higher open this morning. There is one report, at least one person who's been watching all of what's been going on lately, listening to all of the Fed officials talk about whether or not they're going to raise interest rates at their next meeting. Her name is Erin Brown. She's with Point72 Asset Management, and she's now convinced that June is the day, month, that the Fed will raise interest rates again.
June is on the table, and it's probably the most likely scenario right now. And then I think they're going to wait again. And I think that, you know, particularly as we move towards the election, it's going to be hard for the Fed to raise rates again. So I think we'll likely see another hike in the latter part of the year, probably in the fourth quarter.
Erin Brown of Point72 Asset Management, again, saying a June rate hike is likely. The Chicago Fed Reserve president earlier this week said he is happy with the pace of things now, but the Missouri Fed chair says he would like to see that rate increase happen sooner than later. That way, the Fed will have the rest of the year to fix any problems that they might create by that. And this morning on the opening bell, we're going to be talking with Dan Lyons. He's the author of a new book about living in the startup world.
From ABC News, Wall Street Now, Asian shares recovered from early morning losses they suffered after the head of the International Monetary Fund sounded downbeat on the outlook for the world economy. On Wall Street yesterday, the Dow fell 134 points to 17,603. The S&P 500 lost 21. Walmart promises to sell only cage-free eggs by 2025. The nation's largest grocer is joining McDonald's, General Mills, and others which have made the switch. The food industry has been pressed by animal rights groups to improve animal welfare practices. The Justice Department is expected to file suit to stop oil field services company Halliburton from acquiring competitor Baker Hughes. The $35 billion deal would have created a bigger rival to Schlumberger, the world's largest oil field services provider. WhatsApp says it's now using a powerful form of encryption to protect the security of photos, videos, group chats, and voice calls, in addition to text messages sent by a billion users. Some authorities warn that criminals and terrorists can use WhatsApp to hide their tracks. Jim Ryan, ABC News.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
It's 520. Welcome back to the program. Dan Lyons was in his 50s when he lost his job reporting on the tech industry. He took a job at a startup where he was the old guy. His new book is called Disrupted, My Misadventure in the Startup Bubble. Dan Lyons on with us this morning on The Opening Bell. Dan, good morning. First of all, welcome to The Opening Bell. You have been reporting on this for many, many years. You're also one of the writers for the comedy series Silicon Valley on HBO. They have written in the tease of your book here that what you found was ageism, you found extremism, all kinds of stuff that is really kind of scary.
Well, I'm a you know, sort of a comedy writer and a satirist, and I work on a TV show called Silicon Valley on HBO. And meanwhile, before I was doing that gig, and even while I was doing that gig, I worked for a while in a software startup in Cambridge, Mass. After having been a journalist at Newsweek and Forbes for a long, long, long time, and I just came out of it thinking, oh my God, like this startup culture that gets so celebrated and written about in all these Fast Company magazine and everything, it's so absurd and so ridiculous. It's just begging to be mocked. And there you have me, I'm, you know, a comedy guy sitting in there watching all this stuff. And, you know, I can't help but write a book that kind of parodies the whole thing. I mean, it's a nonfiction book. It's not a novel, but it's just so crazy and so weird that I feel like somebody had to write the book, so I did.
So this is not a joke, though. I mean, you've observed real stuff that's happening. I mean, give us an idea of what you saw and what's inside of this startup bubble.
Well, I mean, I went to work for a company in Cambridge that makes software for marketing people. It's not the world's most, you know, sophisticated or noble stuff. It's fairly simple software, and it's useful. It lets you send out email campaigns for promotions and things. But you go into training, and they start talking to you like, you know, you've just joined Scientology. It's like, this isn't software. This isn't about making money. We're on a mission. We're changing the world. We're transforming people's lives, and you're part of this now, and this is going to change your life. And I'm like, no, dude, this is just a job. You know, like I guess I'm older than everybody. Everybody else is like right out of college. They're young kids and they're all looking for meaning and mission. And then there's the whole party thing of like, you know, ping pong tables and, you know, lots of beer and parties and a big Cinco de Mayo thing and a Halloween thing. And it's just, you know, it's like this crazy Candyland. There is actually a wall of candy, like a wall of candy dispensers that they all think is like really cool, like this free candy. I'm like, who cares? It's just free candy, you know, but yeah, in the end, it just turns out to be kind of a bubble. Like it's a bubble world that a few people are making a lot of money on. Everybody else is kind of getting exploited. The reality is it's not really so fun and glamorous once you get in. It's really about burning you out and churning you out. So they have a lot of turnover. People come in and last a year or two, and then they go off and do something else. So it's there's a sort of hypocrisy at the top of it that, again, as someone who writes satire, you walk into this and you can't believe it. It's just like a gift from the comedy gods.
In this book, Disrupted, you talk about some pretty serious issues that are within this little bubble. You talk about ageism. You talk about other, you know, significant problems. Is it like that in all of these startups, or is it just a sampling?
No, this is across the culture. That's the other reason I wanted to write the book, is that it isn't just funny and you can make fun of the crazy language and the rhetoric and stuff. This is, if you look at Silicon Valley in general, even bigger companies, and the average ages are really, really young. And the thing that struck me is I'm in there as an old guy, like, 50 years old, right? That's ancient in this world. Over 40, you basically don't exist. This whole company had hardly anybody over 40 years old. It's run by people in their 20s. And unlike gender bias or race and ethnicity bias, with age bias, they don't even bother to lie. They basically say, our CEO went in the New York Times while I was there and said, no, I really want to hire Gen Yers. I'm trying to build a culture that attracts and retains people in their 20s. Older workers in tech, they don't really get it. The gray hair and experience, it's really not worth anything. They're really overrated. And my jaw fell open. Like, it would be like saying we only want to hire white people. Like, how can you say that? We only want to hire young people. It's insane. And but that is the way it is. That is absolutely the way it is in the tech industry. There's this incredible age bias. There's also incredible race and gender bias. And I think they all go hand in hand. That's one point I did want to make in the book.
You focus on Silicon Valley. Here in Chicago, we have a wonderful startup community, a nice incubator. We talk about this a lot here on The Opening Bell. It's hard to believe that this might be going on in our own backyard a few feet away. Are there some good startups? Are there some of these good innovators that are doing it the right way?
Oh, of course. Yeah. I mean, there are terrific companies coming out. And it may be, if you really, really take the 1,000-foot glance, you might say, if we get one great company, look at Tesla, right? I mean, they're doing great things. They haven't made money yet, but they're making great cars, and they are trying to change a big industry, and they're doing important work. Or SpaceX, Elon Musk's other company that's trying to reinvent travel to space and make it easier to bring payloads out to the space station. Those guys are doing great things. And you might argue that if we get one or two of those, it's worth having 1,000 of these, kind of scammy, pointless, stupid companies that are making photo filters and social apps and stuff like that. And maybe that's okay. But yeah, no, there are definitely people doing tremendous, really good stuff in this world.
There is big money going on here. I mean, it's crazy money in some cases with these venture capitalists. For investors who might be getting into this or thinking about getting into this, you were actually right. You have a good nose for BS. Should their nose be pointing in that direction as well?
Well, it depends on, who you are. I think this is kind of a rigged game. And oddly enough, in 2012, the government passed the Jobs Act, and it did a couple things that actually helped fuel this bubble. And one was it made it easier or possible for mom and pop investors, relatively speaking, to invest in startups at an angel level, like really, really early stage startups. So like get in on the next Facebook. And Silicon Valley lobbied really hard for this, to bring in all this money. And it's kind of dumb money, right? Like, and when you think about it, the companies that they're investing in, like a guy from the SEC warned about this when it happened, which is that you have relatively inexperienced, naive investors putting their money into these syndicates that are going to go invest in brand new startups. But the really good startups, the Ubers and the Airbnbs of the world, they can get money anywhere they want. They're not going to an angel-list syndicate to get their money. So there's a very big chance that if you're in one of these syndicates, you're going to get the dregs. You're going to get the deals that nobody else would invest in. So you have naive investors and mostly companies that are going to flame out. And this guy was saying this is a recipe, the SEC guy was saying this is a recipe for fraud and for disaster, right? So you got to be really careful if you want to dabble in angel investing. You better have a lot of money, and you better be able to say, I can lose all of this money. And if I do, fine, I'll walk away. It's not going to hurt me. You don't want to play with the rent money, right?
You talk about fraud and disaster. Those are two big red flag words. Is there any takeaway from this? I mean, do you have any advice for these startups? Is there anything that the government could be doing more? Or what should we learn from this?
Well, I think we should learn that if you are going to make a startup, I mean, there are great reasons to do it, but do something serious and important, not something flimsy. What's happened in Silicon Valley is that a lot of people have realized you can get real rich really quick overnight. And the kind of people, young people who used to go to, say, work at Goldman Sachs or go to Wall Street and try to get rich quick by working in bond trading, now go to Silicon Valley and try to raise some venture money. They don't even have an idea yet. Then they'll come up with an idea and they'll try to get some traction for it and flip it and get out quick. I think that's a waste of talents and a waste of brain power and a waste of money, even though some people will get rich at it. So I hope that will change.
A lot of us have the memories of this tech crash from the 90s in our minds. Are we headed for that again?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, the question, according to the people I talk to out there who are VCs or investment bankers, is the question is whether the air comes out slowly and it's sort of a soft landing, or whether it just bursts and we have something really harsh like last time where suddenly everybody runs for the exits. And I don't know which it is. But, yeah, you can't have, what, there are 150 or 200 companies supposedly that are worth more than $1 billion. They call them unicorns. And there were, you know, 8 of them a year ago or something. The number of billion-dollar companies supposedly has soared. And everybody knows they're not worth that. And little by little, you're seeing some of them start to implode. They call them unicorpses now. The unicorns become unicorpses. And so far, it's been happening slowly. But yeah, that's going to unwind.
Dan Lines is the author of the New York Times bestseller, Disrupted, My Misadventure in the Startup Bubble. This is The Opening Bell. It's 529 News next.
From ABC News Tech Trends, Aging Education Technology. Scientists say not enough is known about the effects of aging, so they've created an exoskeleton that simulates weight gain, muscle loss, and vision problems.
Some geometric distortion, as well as loss of vision in the middle.
Brand Farron with Applied Mind says the Genworth aging experiment can also help people understand hearing loss. But Paul Hoffman at Liberty Science Center, New Jersey, says the suit is no gimmick.
It starts the dialogue about what aging is like, something we don't like to talk about in our society. So at Liberty Science Center, we want to address these social issues, and we want to do it with absolutely wowing experience, because that changes behavior.
And Farron says this technology could have future benefits.
The technology that we're using to give you the experience of aging will be the thing that can ultimately help many people reverse the effects of aging.
Suit is currently touring museums across the country. With Tech Trends, I'm Andy Field, ABC News.
WGN Radio's Daily Conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
It's 5:38. Welcome back to the program. Joining us in studio this morning is the host of Tomorrow's Business Today on WGN Plus, WGN Radio, Scott Catoon, Mr. Startup himself. Good morning, Scott.
Hi, Steve. It's nice to be here.
I don't know if you were listening to Dan Lyon there, the unicorns to unicorpses. He really didn't paint a good picture of startups.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a culture thing, right? I mean, to be honest, I'm 31, so I'm part of the millennial class barely, I guess, by birth. And when I first left a regular corporate job and went into startup world, I still struggle with it. I don't understand the logic that they use in a, you know, a lifestyle sense.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm almost 50, and I was in a startup, and I was one of the oldest people there, so I see where he's coming from. Is there an ageism thing going on? Or
I think there is. Actually, you know, I can't remember the name of the person who said it, but basically said that all venture capitalists are essentially, you know, too old at 48. So yeah. I think there is ageism. There's also some younger guys thinking, like, listen, we don't do things a good old boy system. We do it differently. We work our own hours, that sort of deal. It's part of a thriving, work-together, collaborative culture. But at the same time, it is not Silicon Valley, the movie or the TV show. It's not as glamorous as it seems. And there's a lot of decisions that are made that I think end up with your, as he said, unicorpses.
Yeah, because some of the guys that are running these and women running these things, they have a heavy load. I mean, they're day to day, you know, where's the money coming from? Am I going to have to fire my employees today? I mean, it must be tough.
It is. It's tough. It's challenging. You know, it's the average startup owner is between 32 and 36, which is sort of people think of actually being younger. Mm-hmm. What that ends up bringing in is they've got a family and kids, which I don't. So for me, it's a little easier. It's a little less pressure. But imagine starting a company that's literally living on a string, and you've got a family with, you know, wife or kids at home to support and things. It's, you know, it's stressful.
Yeah, and the people that you know, like you said, the 30 somethings, the 20 somethings, there's a different, whole different lifestyle there.
Oh yes,
and a different. You work different, but you also learn different. And you've actually introduced me to something new today that I've never heard of, called MOOC. MOOC.
Yep.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, so a MOOC is essentially an online platform. It's an online course, really, for you to take whatever educational platform you want. I actually was turned on to MOOCs when I was at Northwestern in 2013. The former dean of Medill, John Levine, I actually did an interview with him somewhere around 2013 on this. And essentially what it is you can go to Coursera.com, NovoEd. There's a whole bunch of different platforms. And you can take classes that are literally being taught at the world's best universities. And this is a worldwide thing. It doesn't matter where you live. There's 100,000 people can sign on to it, and you can take classes in chemistry, classes in math, education, journalism, media, whatever, you name it, coding, whatever you want to do. And I actually used it as a supplement when I was at Northwestern. There were some classes at Stanford that I wanted in design, and you can sign on. They're starting to charge you now, and UIUC actually now has a degree, which is about $20,000, which is significantly less than what you would normally pay for a grad program. And the entire program is based in a MOOC, which is an online collaborative class where people from all over the world take it.
Yeah, you mentioned UIUC. They've started doing this.
Yep.
What is their program going to be like, and what are they offering?
Well, this is a graduate program. From everything I can read, is it's essentially a science program that they are running. That is a full, unlike a lot of online classes where it's sort of a mixture. You come in here for, you know, a semester or a quarter. You take, you know, take tests here at school. This is entirely online based. So the school here might be in Chicago, but the majority of students literally could be all over the world, and you can take it on your own flexible schedule. And, you know, it's online. So it's literally like you could have a full-time job. You could have whatever you want and just take the classes as you have time.
Yeah. To imagine perhaps a young guy working the farm fields in central Illinois taking classes at Stanford, that seems
like
a mind blower.
And the thing that actually makes this particularly cool is, back to your conversation about the unicorpses, some of these guys that are working crazy hours in the startup world, let's say I don't know one thing. Well, I didn't go to grad school for it, I don't have time. I can go online and take a class over 6 or 8 weeks from Stanford and learn that one thing.
Because as we've talked about here on the Opening Bell, you've always covered this as well. The people who are giving out money, the venture capitalists, the angels, they can smell stupidity and ignorance a mile away.
Yeah, I mean, some of them don't smell it as well as they should, but yeah, in general, they can. And I think for any student or any person, education is massively important. And if you're working a job, if you don't want to become functionally unhireable, it's kind of your responsibility now that it's free.
Free is
free education
is great to hear. Well, on the Tomorrow's Business Today, you have been talking with a company called Tacklebox LLC. Tell us about that.
Tacklebox is amazing. David Kalbaugh is the founder of Tacklebox. So this is what I interviewed David about, which is interesting, is not only is it a marketing company that has about 50% of their deal flow participating with startup companies, helping them brand, helping them create and a brand identity in a world that is, you know, all about branding if you're talking about startup, because you really don't have anything else. The other thing about it is he is a startup. Tacklebox, that helps startups, is a startup. In a year, he's expanded to five different cities, including Chicago. And basically, he, as a former Leo Burnett, you know, advertising executive, he has figured out a way to really bring experiential branding out. And what I mean by that is, companies, it's not just about a logo, it's not just about web page, whatever. It's about making sure that your customers experience you differently. And that, which is important, is why we talk on this show all the time about disruptive companies. Mm-hmm. Startup companies are toppling large and even not massive, but established businesses. Because when I'm the end user, when I go to people like David at Tacklebox, I learn to provide my customers with a feeling of part of community, a feeling of this company is believing in the same values that I do, that the products and the experience is entirely value-based, which is something that a lot of the bigger companies just don't get.
And that's the in thing right now, is this social consciousness, the community-oriented stuff. That's going to be your selling point.
I think it's not only is it an in thing, I think it's a forever thing, because as we start to shift towards a shared economy, whether you're for a shared economy or not, we're going to have elements of a shared economy. With that, you've got impact, social impact. If you're working, you know, if part of your daily life is you work 9 hours, but you spread it throughout the day here, it's important that everyone around here has that same sort of mentality.
Mm-hmm.
And when you build companies and brands, you have to build a culture. And that culture has to expand into your customer base. And if you don't, you're going to lose.
Real quick, coming up, you have Mr. 1871 himself coming up on your
show. I do. Howard Tolman's actually going to be in studio with us tomorrow, which should be pretty exciting. He's going to talk about a lot of things. WISSTEM is one of them, which is a new program at 1871 that's designed for, it's an educational program curriculum designed for women to get them in tech. And we've got partners with Women Tech Founders and Miss Tech, which I'm going to have the presidents of Miss Tech and Women Tech Founders on as well in the coming weeks. So it's an exciting time.
Scott Catoon, the host of Tomorrow's Business Today on WGN Plus, WGN Radio. Always good of you to be with us. You can follow Scott on Twitter at TBT on WGN. Always good to see you.
You too.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
Welcome back to the program. 550 on the WGN Market Desk this morning. Dow futures are pointing toward a higher open on Wall Street, up about 23 points this hour. Oil trading up as well. Let's get the latest on commodities. Here's Orion Samuelson.
Steve, good morning. And as we look at cash hog trade yesterday, a little stronger hog market in the eastern Corn Belt, with Indiana reporting their prices a half dollar higher, Illinois steady with a country top of $43 and a plant top of $45. Livestock futures trade at the Mercantile Exchange yesterday, another tough day for cattle producers. Cattle futures fell to 1.5 month lows, feeder cattle down by nearly 3%. Technical sell-off triggered by ample supplies and lower beef prices in the wholesale market. Live cattle eased their third straight session, briefly falling by the daily limit of $3 per hundredweight before trimming the losses. But we've been finding larger losses in beef prices than cattle prices have pushed packer margins deep into negative territory. So another tough day in the cattle market. That's your money on 720. WGN.
Thanks, Orion Samuelson. 5:52 now on the opening bell. The United Auto Workers Union and others are up in arms against the Ford Motor Company after the company announced it's going to build a new small car plant in Mexico, of all places. And you might imagine this didn't go over too well on the campaign trail yesterday. Here's Donald Trump.
Companies are leaving our country rapidly, whether it's Carrier Air Conditioning, whether it's Ford, whether it's Eaton. So many companies are leaving. And frankly, I'm disgusted with it, and I'm tired of seeing it, and there's no reason for it.
There is bipartisan anger over this. Let's bring in Dale Buss, who has written about this in Forbes on Forbes.com today. Dale, the Ford Motor Company, you write, is getting what it, and the UAW for that matter, getting what it asked for. Talk about this decision, and did Ford really think it was going to get anything other than a fire-breathing rhetoric from people?
Good morning. And, actually, the roots of this whole thing go back even before, well, way before the Donald Trump presidency or Donald Trump campaign for the presidency, because several years ago during the auto bailouts of GM and Chrysler, and, of course, Ford recapitalized itself privately, the whole idea, one idea behind taxpayer support of the bailouts was, okay, let's try and make small car production profitable in the U.S. And at the time, of course, you remember there was $4 a gallon gasoline. So the auto companies did that, and so Ford ended up investing heavily in a plant in suburban Detroit where they make the Ford Focus and some other small cars. General Motors did something similar also around Detroit where they build small cars, and they had to institute two-tier wages, if you remember that term, to do it, where new UAW-represented workers got a much lower wage than the existing ones. And that worked for a while gas prices were high and small car demand was strong, you know, for cars like the Focus. But as gas prices dipped, that introduced one factor which led to this decision. The other thing was, as I pointed out in my Forbes.com story yesterday, when the UAW concluded new labor agreements last fall with the companies, the leadership made the conscious decision, and of course they were encouraged by their membership, to sacrifice long-term job security for immediate financial gain. And you'll recall the first contract out of the chute at Chrysler was actually turned down by the membership because they didn't think they were getting enough money. The auto companies had been profitable for a while, and they hadn't gotten a raise, so they turned the first one down. So the way all this developed is at Ford was, okay, the executives told the UAW, all right, if you're going to insist on a much more lucrative deal than we were planning, then we're probably going to have to move some small car production to Mexico. And that's exactly what the company did. And it's why I said in the headline of my Forbes piece yesterday, this is the UAW only getting what they asked for, in the sense that they knew they were sacrificing some jobs that were going to go to Mexico, but they got a record profit-sharing payout for their workers last year from Ford of $9,300 apiece.
The plant in Mexico is reported to create about 2,800 direct jobs by 2020. Some of the Democrats on the field, too, have been complaining about this. But, you know, NAFTA was a creation, if I'm memory serves me correctly, of the Clinton administration, Bill Clinton's administration, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, President George H.W. Bush started the ball rolling, but Clinton finished it, and he embraced it. And that was part of what made him such a popular president, is he was that, you know, he was practical on economic and fiscal policy, and he recognized the advantage for the U.S. economy and the continental economy of NAFTA. So he pushed it through. So, yeah, that's one of the interesting pieces of the backdrop here, is that the UAW, which, of course, is hugely supportive of Democrats and of Hillary Clinton, can in part blame Bill Clinton for the fix therein, in that it becomes easy for auto companies to want to build in Mexico.
We have about 30 seconds, Dale, here, but you're an expert in branding. Does Ford risk some branding issues here and maybe some blowback from the public?
I don't think so in this particular case. This has been telegraphed for so long and so continuously, especially by Donald Trump in the campaign. I don't think it's going to hurt the Ford brand. I mean, Ford's point is, look, we've invested $10 billion in the U.S. over the last several years. We employ more workers in the U.S., and they actually do, than any other auto company. Don't think it's going to have huge implications for Ford as a brand. And it's probably going to play out more significantly in the presidential race.
I have to leave it right there. Dale, thanks for being with us on the opening bell this morning.
You bet.
You can read Dale's story on Forbes.com and follow Dale on Twitter at Dale D. Bus. That's the opening bell for this morning. Producers Mary Sandberg, production help from Bennett Wakenight. Our engineer, as always, Ben Cortez. Steve Cochran's up next. It's 5:58.